This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Across Northern Ireland, on your radio and on BBC Sounds. This is The Stephen Nolan Show!
What am I doing here in the studio? Should I not be working from home? Should all of us who could work from home not work from home for the next couple of weeks during this cold snap to reduce the chance of accidents, not driving, not cycling, not out walking on slippy pavements, to try and take the heat off, to try and ease the pressure on our health service? We talk about that on the programme today. Even should we cancel our five-a-side football, soccer, hockey, our tennis matches to avoid the risk of hurting our knee again, breaking an ankle again, to ease the pressure on our hard-working health staff. Just for a couple of weeks. Is it too much to ask? We talk to some medical experts about that. And we also talk about flags. Yes, flags again. We don't look back, though. We look forward. The Alliance Party has this proposal to regulate the flying of flags. But what does that actually mean? Are we talking about a flag equivalent of the Parades Commission? Have a listen. We hear arguments for and against doing something new in terms of regulation of flag flying here in Northern Ireland. Lots to listen to on the programme. Thanks for your company. The Stephen Nolan Show! Good morning, happy Tuesday. Thanks to everyone who called in yesterday, and we want to hear from you today again. If you've been affected by the current crisis in our hospital emergency departments, and even if you haven't, because let's face it, folks, the reality of life is that any one of us could be next. So should we be adjusting our lifestyles accordingly? Stay at home when we can. Cancel that weekly five-a-side football session until next month when things improve. Stay off our bikes. Don't go shopping unless we have to. You get the idea. Only do the essentials. Let's ask that question to some medical professionals, including Dr. Alan Stout, the chair of the BMA in Northern Ireland. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning, Mark.
Should I be working from home?
It's a very good question. We have a short-term major problem here at the moment, and that is the flu that's circulating. We have lots of infection circulating, but the flu is dominating it. And that's what's causing the big pressure on our health service, right across GPs, into our emergency departments, and into then our hospitals and our admissions, and then the difficulty with discharging. So what we have to do at the moment to try and get ourselves out of it is, first of all, protect as many people as we can, and that is vaccination, just pure and simple, to try and protect against serious illness. But also then, exactly as you're mentioning, I think just as a population, as a community, we have to be conscious of trying to minimise the spread of infection. And that is just being simple and sensible about going into crowded spaces. And if you are infectious, so the answer to your question, this is a long-winded answer to your question, the answer to your question is, if you're symptomatic, you probably shouldn't be at work at the moment, because that would suggest that you've spread it on your way into work, while you're at work, and on your way home from work, and that's not particularly sensible.
What about wearing masks again in the workplace or even around towns and villages?
Yeah, again, it's a good question. So I'm sitting in my surgery now. I've actually been frantically trying to get through a ever-increasing list that's sitting in front of me, and I've told a number of people who are quite symptomatic to come down to practice, for me to have a look at them, assess them, and see what we need to do. And I've actually said to them, if they're symptomatic, please wear a mask if you're coming down, because you will spread it to other people. So again, it's just that sensibility around it. If you feel like you've got symptoms, if you feel like you're going to be contacting other people, do everything you can. And don't forget, let's go back to COVID. The big value of a mask is actually protecting other people, not yourself. So if you've got any hint of symptoms and think that you might be spreading infection, I think that's only fair on other people, particularly actually, Mark, in healthcare settings where we have a lot of very vulnerable patients.
And what about those of us who enjoy a game of five-a-side football?
Yeah, so again, we've got to be realistic. This isn't about stopping life. Our problem at the moment is infection. Our problem is flow in hospitals. So people will pick up injuries. They'll pick up the normal run of life and so on. And that is okay. We want to be sensible. Try your utmost to minimize those. We're not expecting people to stop their normal life and normal activities. But just be conscious of not getting unnecessary injuries. Again, that's a positive within the health service as well. One of the big changes that's been made is the introduction of minor injury units. So there's separate streams for minor injuries to the actual emergency department. And that has actually proven to be quite a successful project and does separate those two groups of patients quite successfully.
Two last things, because I'm very aware that you have a list there and we're keeping you back. What do you say to those of us who've managed to avoid the lurgy so far? No matter what age we know it can floor us. How do we avoid getting it?
Yeah, again, it's just common and simple sense. We all became so good at it during COVID, and I suspect everybody remembers those simple hygiene type precautions, so washing your hands, coughing or sneezing into an elbow or into a tissue or a hanky, you know, just avoiding that spread and avoiding that contact. So it is just about sensibilities. If you're symptomatic or you know somebody else is symptomatic, try not to be too close to them at this particular point in time.
And we know we have a lot of good citizens out there, Alan, just finally. If somebody's listening and says, you know what, I am going to put my normal life on hold for a while, just for the greater good, what sort of timescale are we looking at in terms of this current crisis dying down?
Yeah, I mean, we're really expecting a problem over the next couple of weeks. We know there's been lots and lots of circulation over the Christmas period. We know that we'll see the impact of that on the spreading infection. So the next couple of weeks are going to be really difficult. One of the big things, and the Health Committee is clearly meeting this afternoon, is that we don't create this kind of legacy tail of the problem that we're facing over the next few weeks, which will then impact our health service for months and months to come. And that's why there's this real urgency for change of how we deliver service. Everybody's talking the right talk and saying the right things. We've got to see that change. We've got to see the support into general practice, into the community, and supporting our patients out of hospital, both before they need to go into hospital and once they're in hospital, trying to get them discharged. There are fantastic plans there that just haven't been implemented, and we need to implement them really, really quickly so we're not facing this for months to come, and we're not talking about it this time next year again.
Dr. Alan Stout, thank you very much indeed. Apologies to your patients who have been waiting patiently, if you pardon the pun. All eyes are on Stormont and that health committee today. One person who's going to be there is on the line now, the SDLP MLA, Colin McGrath. Good morning.
Good morning.
What do you think about this issue of people staying at home if they can?
Well, look, I don't think we should be alarming people unnecessarily. And I think that what Alan has said there is very practical and very sensible. It is that people just exercise sense. If you've got flu symptoms, then you change how you go about your daily life, whether you can work from home, whether you can avoid going out into big spaces with lots of other people. They're all just very sensible things. But I think that we need to really understand as well, this isn't a crisis necessarily about the flu. It's a crisis that our health service isn't in a shape to be able to cope with it. And that's what we really have to get to dig underneath and find out why. And then also we need to be looking for those solutions, again, that Alan has said, that will help to transform our health service so that it is able to cope with these things. Because as just every year, we have Christmas just after it, we have a flu season, we see an increase in pressure on our health services. We're told that pressure is as relevant in July and August as it is in the winter time. Yes. So therefore, we need to see some extra help in the winter time to be able to cope with these things.
Well, we look forward to hearing what your solution's going to be. I'm going to come back to you, Colin McGrath. I want a quick word first of all, though, with Deirdre Heenan, Professor of Social Policy at Ulster University. Deirdre, good morning. As a professor of social policy, how social should we all be at the moment?
Well, I think the key thing is that we are sensible and we should mitigate risk. So we shouldn't be out ice skating if we're not good at it. Five-a-side, yes. Sea swimming, yes. I mean, it's important to look after our mental health as well as our physical health. Mm-hmm. But I don't think we should be engaged in risky behaviours at this particular time of the year.
Sea swimming's okay. I'm glad you said that.
It is.
Okay, that's good. Stay with us. Tony McMullen is from the Civil Service Pensioners Alliance. Tony, what's your advice?
Well, I think the advice that we're getting from the professionals is the most critical thing. And so what Alan Stout seemed to suggest was eminently sensible and reasonable in all of the circumstances. I think people need to be sensible. They need to wear masks that are appropriate. I mean, I've recently had the occasion to be visiting a close relative who was in hospital from the 27th of December and then got released in the last few days. And I was at the Ulster Hospital, saw at first hand the experience of both the patients and the staff in the reception area of A&E, which was absolutely horrendous. What was happening in the corridors, the impact that this was having on the dedicated staff, both the ambulance staff and the staff in the hospitals. It was heartbreaking, actually, to see it, because my sister was waiting in an ambulance for 10 hours before admission. And it was almost the entire time that the ambulance staff were on duty that particular day, and they weren't spending it doing what they are professionally qualified to do, which is to go out and look after patients, but they were actually sitting in a car park outside A&E waiting to discharge someone into hospital. At one stage, I saw 23 ambulances waiting outside the Ulster Hospital. So that's really horrendous. And so we all need to take the professional advice from our health professionals, and we need to follow that very carefully. But it's not the staff's fault, the crisis that's in the hospitals. The politicians really need to grasp this nettle and to do something about it. Otherwise, it's going to happen again next year and the year after and the year after.
Tony, sadly, it rolls off our tongue now when we talk about people being in an ambulance outside a hospital for 10 hours. What's that like? Are you allowed to go in and visit your relative? You open the doors, they get cold. Tell us a bit more about it.
Well, myself and my and other siblings were there. It was a very small, contained space. We had an ambulance staff member there. My relative was there on a wheelchair, and then we only had enough room to squeeze one other person in. So I was there for some time. My other siblings were there for a short period of time as well. So we were all sitting there, but we were just chatting to the ambulance staff about the difficulties that they were experiencing, and they were, the ambulance staff, to be fair, were going out of their way to be helpful. They were getting tea and coffee for my relative, for me, for my siblings, and just talking about the pressures that they were under. And it's really, really difficult. And they said, you know, they're very professionally, highly qualified staff. They want to get out and do what they do best, but they can't do it because they're just sitting in an ambulance. Yeah. And the other thing is that they have to keep the ambulance on in order to keep the heat in the ambulance for the patient. The ambulance itself has to be kept on, and that's wasting energy as well.
Absolutely, yeah. I'm sure there's a bit of a smell as well. Tony, stay with us, because Colin and then Deirdre are going to give us some ideas in terms of solutions. You kick off, Colin.
Well, obviously, if there was only a handful of solutions and I could do it in a radio segment with you, it would all be sorted by this afternoon. But unfortunately, that's not where we are. What we do need is, first of all, to examine the key pinch points and where the problems are. And I think there's been a lot of work done on that. So, for example, it's the exiting from hospital where there are significant problems. Because, you know, I think the BBC was reporting there at the weekend that there were 500 patients that were ready to go home, but because circumstances couldn't be put in place for them through community care and other services, they were unable to leave, which meant that the backup ran right the way through to the ambulances that Tony had mentioned there. So there does need to be investment for investment in the transformation for those types of resolutions. We require the whole executive to come together. What we do not need is in a four-party executive, is three of the parties sniping from the sidelines over the weekends about how terrible things are. There needs to be a whole executive response. There was a whole executive response to COVID, and things moved pretty quick at times there whenever things needed to change around. And I think that's the sort of move that we need to see now. And that's what the SDLP will be pushing for. That's the role of being a constructive opposition, is pushing and directing an executive that currently isn't doing what it needs to do.
I'm writing that down. As you say, it's multifaceted, but that's one idea, that take this off the only shoulders of Mike Nesbitt and make it a whole executive issue. Deirdre Heenan, have you any ideas? I'm sure you do.
Well, I suppose the first thing to say is no one should be surprised at this situation. We have been discussing reform for two decades. These debates happen every winter. And if it is predictable, it is preventable. So the question is, what is the preparation for this? What is the action plan? What is the escalation plan? Where is the scaling up? Where is the additional funding? Where is the way to deal with almost inevitable pressures at this time of the year? Hand-wringing and platitudes are cold comfort to people who are languishing in hospital, unable to leave, or those people who are in the back of an ambulance, or those people who cannot access the system. And this is about a system. It's not just about hospitals, either in or out of hospitals. It's about the whole system of health and social care and how we organise it to ensure that we get the best value for money, that people get the best treatment that they're seen in the most timely fashion. And we are simply failing. And there's no other way to talk about this other than to say, we have talked the talk. We are very good at talking the talk, but where is the action? Yesterday, I was speaking to a consultant in Daisy Hill, and he said it was soul destroying to go to work and see people lined up in the corridors, people not getting the care that they want to give to people. Mm. It isn't their fault. We're not blaming them. But the system is clearly not working. And so if, for example, we accept that we are better funded than our counterparts in England, who encounter very similar problems.
Yes, they do.
Well equipped to deal with them. And I think, Mark, that is the difference. We are not saying that this is unique to Northern Ireland, but what we are saying is the response that we get in Northern Ireland is absolutely unique. The key question for me is, who is in charge here? Who is running this show? Is it the minister? Is it the Department of Health? Is it the chief executive of the trusts? There's absolutely no transparency about what decisions have been made, what actions have been taken, how we can mitigate some of these things. The idea that 500 people in Northern Ireland on one night are languishing in a hospital, medically fit to go home, but unable to go home.
So what's your plan, Deirdre Heenan? What's your plan?
Well, my plan is that we have a detailed plan to address some of these issues. For example, if someone's in hospital, unable to go home, what is the problem? Is it that we don't have enough community care?
Yes.
Is it that we don't have enough residential care?
Yes.
That we don't have enough step-down beds?
Yes.
Yes, and the answer to all of these is yes. But also, again, if you look at England and Wales, what have they done? They have trained paramedics within the community so that, for example, if you're calling an ambulance, you may not need to go to hospital. They can prescribe. They can give you follow-up appointments. They can give you detailed advice to stop you going to hospital. There are more district nurses. There are more occupational therapists. There are specialist falls teams to ensure that frail and elderly people do not end up in hospital unless it is entirely unavoidable. So there are many initiatives that could happen. But what I would say is you can't look at one initiative and say this will address the problem. You look at the issue in the round and the first thing you say is, are we underfunding social care? Northern Ireland is unique, and I think it's really important to stress this. We are unique in the UK in that we have an integrated health and social care system. Notionally, that should mean we have a one-stop, seamless service for people who are in hospital moving to social care. Unlike in England, where social care is the responsibility of local and district councils. So we really should be in a position of saying, look at how we do it. We're the exemplar. People move seamlessly from one area to another area. We know what people need and we're well prepared. Instead, what we have is chaos. And when people are in hospital and they're ready to go home, they are deteriorating not only physically, but mentally. They're likely to be depressed. They're likely to be anxious. Will I ever get out of here? They will have muscle wastage. They're likely to be in contact with a hospital-acquired infection. It is a very difficult situation for people that could be avoided.
Okay.
But I think the key thing, Mark, is also very expensive to keep people in hospital beds who should actually be home or within the community? And why are we simply reporting numbers and saying 500 people? Let's investigate that and look at the cost of that, the money wasted, the suboptimal use of limited resources, okay. And why is that allowed to continue?
Deirdre, stay with us. Tony McMullen, what do you think of what Deirdre Heenan has just had to say?
Well, I think that there's a lot of sense to what Deirdre's had to say. Obviously, she's a professional working in the area of social policy and will have a lot of experience at that. I mean, I think that some of what they're doing in Great Britain, and particularly in England, seems to be very interesting about having people on the ground to make sure that only the most vulnerable people, only the people who actually need to go to hospital, do have to go to hospital, and a lot of people can be dealt with by, for example, district nurses in the community, which we don't really seem to have here. But one of the things I also wanted to say, Mark, is that one of the concerns that we had, and we raised this before on the Nolan Show, was the government's reduction, or taking away, the withdrawal, sorry, of the winter fuel allowance. And we said at the time that we believed that this would have an impact on a lot of elderly staff. Forget about the millionaires who are entitled to the winter fuel allowance, not all of which take it, by the way.
Yes.
But think of those people who are just above the pension credit limit, people on £13,000 a year. We said at the time that if that was taken away from them, that there would be an impact and the rise of elderly people in hospitals this winter, and that's what's coming to pass. And I think it's absolutely critical that the government waken up, the government of Westminster waken up and do what they're doing, at least in the Assembly, where they've agreed to pay £100, and in the Scottish Parliament, where they've agreed to reintroduce the winter fuel allowance for elderly people who desperately need that money in order to keep their homes heat this winter.
Yep.
And if they don't have it, what we're seeing in the significant increase of older people going to hospital will continue.
Tony, thank you. Jason's on the line from Coleraine. Morning, Jason.
Good morning. Yes, last crisis did impact me because I was in the hospital and I sat in A&E for 18 hours and they told me they would get me a bed. Then for 3 days I sat in a corridor on a trolley before I got moved to a ward. But the point I want to make here is the health committee might be meeting today, but this is a crisis. Should the executive and the whole assembly not be recalled back?
Let's put that to Colin McGrath from the SDLP. What do you think, Colin?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the exact point that I've been making for the last couple of days, is that I don't think, I mean, anybody that thinks that there's going to be some sort of magic bullet today from the Health Committee is in for a great disappointment. We're going to have the Minister in today. Of course, we can ask him a certain number of questions. But if he is going to come in today, and I could almost guarantee it and say that he doesn't have the money to create the transformation that will sort the system out, then that's a decision that the entire executive has to take. So I am quite surprised that the executive isn't getting together for a special meeting to look at the issues that there are within our health service to say what support can be provided. That's what's happening everywhere else. Whenever there's a problem in the government, with the department, the government gets together to try and find a solution. But of course, it's not what happens here. What happens here is that three of the four parties stand back and tut at the fourth party for not being able to sort it all out.
We don't know what's going on behind the scenes. Maybe we'll find out. Michael's on the line from Belfast. Morning, Michael.
Hi, Mark. As you know, I call you Super Sub, our little personal connection. Tell you what it is, Mark. I'm an old man. I'm nearly 65. But when I go to the dentist, I will come back and take my Samoyed dog from Siberia and have hours of fun up the Cave Hill. But I wouldn't go out the door and up there without my snow grips, my ice grips. And having been up in the past, we go over the top and you go down the back to the Upper Cavell Road, and I would see young kids coming up in trainers and inappropriate footwear, and they're risking like serious injury and further impacting on the war zone A&E departments, which we have.
Wear better footwear if you have it, then, is the message from Michael.
I look for snow grips, ice grips, they're cheapest chips, and
how much are they?
They're not dear, my friend. I actually, some years ago, when we had a drop of snow, I got a load and gave them to friends and family and that, because I'm quite a generous boy, you know.
What do you mean by ice grips? Excuse my ignorance.
Well, what it is, Mark, they're like rubber ice things. You put them over your boots and there's like little cleats in them, and means that you can walk on ice with absolute safety.
Are you on social media? Can you send me a picture of them?
Of course I will. Okay. Also, by the way, my dog, Mr. Phillips and Anne-Marie Wallace and Kerry McLean know him well. He's a bit of a Radio Ulster star. You know, he sang on a Radio Ulster.
Right.
Have a good day, Mark.
And you, Michael. Happy New Year to you. Last call before the 9:30 news. Ray is on the line from Drummore. Hi, Ray.
Good morning, Martin. I've just had a... In fact, I'm sitting outside Craig Evan Hospital at the minute, and both the car parks are chock-a-block with, obviously, patients arriving for appointments or visitors. But on the way up, I had cars tail-ending me, and the system in my vehicle warns me if there's an obstruction behind me, and it kept going off because vehicles were driving so close to me. As well as that, there are a lot of vehicles on the road with either no headlights.
Oh, my goodness.
Or only one headlight.
Oh, my goodness.
Uninformed, is 3 points waiting to happen.
Yep. Should
traffic branch decide to pull them in.
Yep.
But it's the speed, and, of course, it was snowing quite heavily.
Yep.
And
come on,
people,
folks, let's just be careful out there. I think that's your message, Ray, isn't it?
It is, but not only that, where there's an accident, it's adding to the problem for hospital staff.
It is, Ray. Ray, thank you for highlighting that, literally highlighting that issue. It's coming up to 9:32. Keep your calls coming. Deirdre, stay with us if you can. Colin McGrath, stay with us if you can. Lots more to come on The Nolan Show this Tuesday. It's Mark Simpson in the hot seat on what is an increasingly cold week here. We're going to hear from a nurse in a minute or two who's right at the heart of this health crisis at the moment, doing her best in very difficult circumstances. But before we hear from her, I want a last word quickly from Deirdre Heenan and Colin McGrath. All eyes on Stormont, Colin McGrath. I think it's 4 o'clock, the committee meeting today. Realistically, can that change anything?
I would very much doubt it, and I would advise people to probably be getting home with their lives and looking at the Stormont Health Committee for solutions. I suspect the Health Minister will come and tell us that he doesn't have enough money to be able to deal with the current situation, advise the public to take care, and I really think that it is about what we do next. We need to be able to say, it's January now, what are we doing to prepare for next January? What is it that will be different that will make that change? And then we have to go about observing to make sure that that change takes place.
Is it 4 o'clock?
Yes, I hope so. That's the time I'm going for.
Okay. And, you know, back to what we started with, the idea of working from home, can committee members tune in remotely?
They can. I'm currently sitting looking out my window across the sort of mid part of County Down, and there's a bit of snow, and I'm wondering whether it's sensible to go, but it certainly looks like it might be clear enough, so I think I'll risk going on purpose because there's other meetings in Stormont today as well this afternoon.
Well, stay safe. Deirdre Heaton.
Thank you.
Deirdre, what are your expectations of this 4 o'clock summit?
I'd just like to make a point before we mention that. We've talked about risk this morning. Colm's talking about looking out his window. Spare a thought for the army of domiciliary care workers here.
Yes.
Length and breadth of Northern Ireland on snow, on back roads, untreated roads, dangerous conditions to bring care to people who are vulnerable and elderly on the minimum wage, largely women. We've got to address this. We've got to address the social care workforce. What do I expect from today? Well, what do we get every time we have a health committee? We have hand-wringing, we have platitudes, we are disappointed, we are outraged. These people are in charge. We currently spend 52% of our block grant on health and social care. That is not going to increase substantially. It would be simply unsustainable. So we have got to work out how we use those resources in the best possible way. And it is very clear to anyone watching that we are not spending our money well. So we should not accept our politicians saying we need more money. What we want to know is, how are you spending that money? Can you come and talk to us? There needs to be much more transparency, much more accountability, and a detailed action plan as to how we will never find ourselves in this position again.
And Deirdre Heenan, before you go back to what you were talking about, those care workers on the minimum wage, some of them maybe listening to us in between jobs now, getting the minimum wage for maybe helping elderly people wash themselves, go to the toilet for the minimum wage.
It's extraordinary, but these people are doing it because they want to do it. They choose to do it. It's a vocation. You certainly wouldn't do it for the money. You would much rather go and get a job in a supermarket. But they are delivering essential care. We've got to get to the point where we value these care workers, where we respect them, where we pay them, we ensure that people have dignity in their own homes. And that way you're avoiding people going into care. Now, we don't have exact figures, but we know that delivering care packages at home is much more efficient than having people in hospital for all sorts of reasons, and indeed having people in residential care. So it is extraordinary to me that when we talk about cuts, and we talked about cuts earlier this year, the first thing the Department of Health cut are social care packages. It's extraordinary. These people need to be recognised, they need to be valued, they need to be properly paid, and we need to have a serious discussion about the future of care, which for far too long has been the poor relation in Northern Ireland.
You know what I'm going to ask you next. If you're going to pay them more, where do you get the money from?
Well, I mean, I could find many ways to bring that money into the system. For example, if you didn't have people languishing in hospital waiting to be discharged at possibly £1,000 a day, as opposed to sometimes £300 a week for a care package, think how much money here. If we didn't set up unnecessary, ludicrous bureaucratic systems in each trust, we're now setting up new bureaucratic systems. If we swept away some of the bureaucracy,
would you get rid of the five trusts, make it one?
Well, if it was up to me, I certainly would.
Oh, interesting.
No doubt about it. Why? Well, Manchester, and I know we both like talking about Manchester.
Oh, they're back, Deirdre. They're back.
I know, isn't it? What a way to start the year. We would have one trust and we would have one chief executive, and that chief executive would be responsible and accountable and would be on this show with you this morning saying, this is the plan to deal with this. It is my responsibility and this is what I'm going to do. What we have is finger pointing, buck passing. Is it the department? Is it the trust? Is it the hospital? Is it the minister? Is it the health committee? This is where the problem lies. We need ownership of this issue and a real plan of action going forward.
Professor Deirdre Heenan, thank you. Thanks also to Colin McGrath. If you're going to Stormont, drive carefully. If you're one of those care workers driving around, whether it's Fermanagh or Armagh or Antrim, give us a call if you can, when it's safe to do so, and tell us about your job. Tell us what it's been like recently. Tell us what would make your job a little bit easier. I suppose a little more money would help. We have heard from a nurse already who contacted the programme. Pauline, not her real name, talked about what life is like at the moment on the health service frontline.
I just think it's really important that this is highlighted, the struggles that the health service are facing at the minute. I feel like it's kind of this silent ticking bomb in the background that everybody's going around their day. But the health service, which really is the centre of everything, it's like a pot that is boiling over, if that makes any sense. So it's kind of been simmering away for a while, and it's now at the point that it is boiling over. It's not even at boiling point, you know, it's boiling over. And I just think it's important to hear from people on the inside of that.
Are you able to tell us where you work and exactly what you see?
Yeah, so I work in primary care. So we're kind of the first point of contact for patients. I also work in an out-of-hours service, so that's primary care out-of-hours as well for people. We are the first people that patients see, really. And the problems that we are having is that we are seeing patients who need specialist care. So referrals are done. And as we all know, we talk about waiting lists. Waiting lists are horrendous. So those patients that are being referred on are waiting for months, sometimes years. So what happens then as a result of that is that patient recurrently comes to see their GP for the same problem. Now the GP can do whatever they can to manage that problem within primary care, but ultimately our system is designed that sometimes you need specialist input. So what happens is those people with chronic issues, they become more and more unwell. And then in the middle of all of this, as we've had on this morning, the you know, one of the directors of the ED has said, everybody then ends up in the ED. So you've got your acutely unwell people that need to go to ED. It's the only place that they can go. But then the bottleneck is people that are waiting on specialist services. They're becoming more and more unwell on waiting lists. So their only choice is to end up in the ED. And so you've got these people who are desperate and they don't know where else to go. So it's really difficult. It's really difficult that we have so many more patients coming through for repeated problems, and ultimately their route into hospital seems to have become through the ED, if that makes sense.
Pauline, I don't want to minimise what you're saying, but is it not like this every year?
No, honestly, like in the last 10 years, I don't think I've seen it this bad. So I work in primary care at the moment, but I have done my share of working in emergency medicine as well. And it is not the same. I was actually speaking to an ED nurse last week, and she was saying that she had triaged a patient. And now you need to be careful what you're saying, but triaging is where we assess the patient and decide how urgently they need to be seen. So she had triaged this patient and was like, right, this patient needs to be seen urgently, and had a moment of panic because she knew on the other side of that triage room door, there was nowhere to put that patient. And that patient was acutely unwell. So if we're deciding that patient needs seen urgently, there's a threat to life. So she had a moment of panic and she had to make a makeshift bay, you know, this corridor care that we're talking about, in order for this patient to be seen urgently. Now, I have never seen where a patient needs to be seen that urgently and we have nowhere to put them. Usually, we can move someone else who's maybe, you know, come in very unwell, but they've stabilised. But when you've got all of your urgent beds filled with people who are still acutely unwell and not stable, where do you go from there? So I understand, you know, the general public saying, oh, sure, well, it's always like this. Honestly, genuinely, it's not. It's not. It has been worsening over the last few years. But as I say, I think boiling point has been reached. And you can see those pressures on NIAS as well. You know, the ambulance service, people waiting, you know, unbelievable for an ambulance. Not any person's fault. That's not the ambulance driver. That's not the paramedic. That's the service. They want to go. People, they want to help people. They don't want to leave we Joe public who fail lying for 12 hours before anybody gets to him. But that's where we are.
Pauline, it's not a great line, and I know your time is short. What's the answer? What are you saying to Mike Nesbitt, the health minister? He's bound to be listening.
I think Mike Nesbitt acknowledged it on the show on Friday, how horrific things are. But I do think that there needs to be a big look at funding. And I know everybody says that, but that is the long and short of it, is that people aren't paid enough. People are leaving their jobs. We're trying to run the service on agency staff. And, you know, there's so it's not a quick fix. This is a long-term problem that needs a long-term solution. But it's just going to get worse if we keep going the way we are.
And finally, what about you yourself? How are you feeling about your career within medicine?
A wee bit down in the dumps about it, to be honest. I became a nurse because I wanted to care for people. And I feel like we're just kind of clutching at straws at the minute, and we're putting plasters over hemorrhaging wounds is the way to describe it. So I want us to do better. I want us to be better. And we can't do that without the support.
What's the mood in the staff room generally?
People are just... The staff morale is really low, and it has been for a while. But, you know, people are just... Tired? We're tired. Fed up.
And it's only the 6th of January.
I know. It's going to be a long odd year, isn't it? But hopefully, I mean, I don't know. Broadcasters covering this is important because we can't just pretend it's not happening. We can't. You know, until it's you or your family that need it and see how awful it is, we can't leave it till then when people start noticing. Do you know what I mean?
That's the point, because we all think, oh, it'll never happen to me.
Well, this is it. This is it. And it's until it does happen, you know, until it does happen. And thankfully, we have great nurses and doctors who will do their absolute best for anybody if it happens to them. But we can only work with the resources that we have. And if there's physically not a bed to put you in, you can imagine how that feels for the nurses and the doctors.
Pauline, thank you. If you were listening carefully, you would have realised we recorded that interview yesterday. It is now the 7th of January. Thanks to Pauline. We wish her and all of her colleagues well. I'd really like, though, to hear from a care worker, someone that Professor Deirdre Heenan was talking about, someone going from house to house today through the snow doing their job. I'd love to hear a bit more about what you're going through and what you think needs to happen next. Speaking of houses, should we all be staying in our houses if we can at the moment to give our health service a bit of a break? Let's talk to Belfast businessman Chris Souter, who runs a shop in the city centre and who was maybe, just maybe, throwing things at the radio when I suggested we all stay at home at the start of the programme. Were you, Chris?
Mark, to be fair, I have to give the team props today. That's been a great bunch of contributors on there this morning. And to be fair, Mark, you probably have changed my opinion slightly, particularly that that last lady was on. Obviously, I would be coming on the radio to say, to tell people, like, please keep coming into the towns and your local centres, and please keep shopping, because at the end of the day, the country is an ecosystem. The ecosystem revolves around people getting out of their houses, Mark, and getting into their cars and going shopping and keeping the whole ecosystem, the whole money system turning and turning and turning. But then you do hear some, you hear someone within the health service themselves, Mark, and you made a good point. If it's not at your own door, maybe it's not at the front of your mind. And certainly with me at the minute, I've been very, very lucky over this last while that none of my family have ended up in hospital with respiratory illnesses. The one thing that I would say there was, you know, we have to work to, I say this all the time, Mark, it seems like there's nobody in charge. And at the minute, again, as most of the contributors have mentioned, it seems like there's nobody in charge of this wee country. And we really need Stormont to come up here and sort this out so that it doesn't happen again next year. Again, if you push me on the people coming out in the shop, remember there's a lot of difference between the cold and the flu. And I would ask people to make sure if they do have or they think they have a flu, yes, by all means, take the necessary precautions. But if it's just a cold, Mark, we deal with the cold every single year and every single month. There's cold issues. So it's just trying. It's hard to find the balance, Mark, between scaremongering with a bigger issue and telling people that, you know what, it's okay, this is just part of the season, and please do just go about, you know, we're still scarred with COVID, Mark, and I get that. You know, I totally do get that we're worried about the next big issue, particularly in respiratory side of things. So I can understand if people did want to take those precautions, as Alan Stout said, and just look, if you're symptomatic, stay in. But I would also then argue the point that, you know, we do need to keep the cities and the town centres and the economy running. So we do need to still be out there spending money, Mark.
Do you get many people coming into your shop, Chris, wearing a mask these days?
Haven't seen somebody wearing a mask in forever, Mark. But again, I get that. And Alan made that point too, that we did get caught up in the whole COVID thing, that masks were meant to protect us from other people. The masks that we wear, those little cloth masks and those little plastic masks, they actually work better protecting other people from us, because as we're breathing in and out, you know, the little mask or catching at least something that's coming out of our bodies. So, masks probably do a job as such, but no, I haven't seen anybody wearing masks, and I don't know if I'd want to get back into that whole mask wearing business, Mark. It was terrible. But again, you hear from the health workers and you hear, yeah, you know, Deirdre, I thought she made a lot of great points. And, you know, for me, I'm now looking to Stormont, Mark. I'm looking for leadership, as I say on this programme all the time.
Well, the health committee's meeting at 24 hours notice. What more do you want?
Yeah, well, what I want is this not to happen next year, Mark.
Okay.
It's the same thing with the roads and the road works before Christmas. Let's take it as it is. We are where we are. This is happening at the minute. Let's look towards next year and make sure it doesn't happen again.
Speaking of Christmas, front page of the newsletter, Ulster Unionist Councillor Jim Rogers says some businesses endured one of their worst Christmases in many years in Belfast. Did you?
Mark, we had a good December. I'm not going to lie, we had a good December. December on the run-up of the sale in our industry was quite good. I feel particularly sorry for anyone in the hospitality game, particularly in the restaurant game, because those were the guys that probably get hit the hardest. There were elements of the city that were closed off due to the roadworks that get hit harder than the rest. So, Jim does make a point. It was bad for some people, Mark, but it was good for a lot of other people. Now, post-Christmas, post-sale, certainly our numbers have been way, way down, but that I can't really blame that on the traffic or on the roadworks. So that's maybe just kind of shopping trends. Mark,
you're getting all mellow in this new year in 2025.
I know, what's this about?
You'll be praising John O'Dowd next.
Oh, my goodness. But do you know what, Mark? And see, to be fair, I did give the whole traffic thing a bit of a run over Christmas.
You did.
At some point, I was asking myself, going, you know, Chris, you gotta start talking the city up again. But Mark, all I'm asking for is leadership. I'm not asking for much. I don't think I'm asking for leadership, departmentally specifically, and then straight up into the storm at the end of things. We need our politicians to stop thinking short term and start thinking long term. It's as if they're always on this little 3, 4, 5 year voting run, and they only really worry about, Mark, what's on their desk there and now. There's no strategic planning in this country, I think, as a whole. And that's the one thing, particularly this health issue, is really bringing that to the fore, that we need to sort ourselves out, Mark. We need leadership from the very top level, and they all need to take control of this.
Stay with us if you can, unless you get overwhelmed by customers on a cold Tuesday morning, however unlikely that may be.
Unlikely.
Niamh's on the line from Belfast as well. Morning, Niamh.
Hi, Mark. I'm actually from Castlewellan in County Down.
Oh.
Yep, on the 29th of December, I went to see my GP, got an appointment straight away, thankfully. My GP then sent me to the Royal at an emergency with suspected clot. I arrived at the Royal at 3 p.m. that day, and I was sitting in the Royal A&E for 24 hours.
24 hours on a chair.
On a chair, 24 hours. Now, I was triaged pretty quick. I was a healthcare assistant myself for 10 years. I'm a survivor, a breast cancer survivor. So I know how hard the nurses and doctors work. Triaged pretty quick. Blood's done pretty quick. But from then, it was carnage. It was like a hotel. With people coming in vaping, people coming in drinking, taking drugs, toilets.
Taking drugs?
Yeah. All the toilets overflowing, urine on the floor, just lying in the chairs in a drunken state, and, you know, had accidents. I finally got called then back in for OBS again from the nurse. I did ask her, you know, where I was in the list. She said I was priority. Second on the list. She's trying to find me a bed desperately. Eventually, the next, from about 4 o'clock that morning till 10 past 8, I want to say, there was no doctors came out and called anybody. Then as soon as the doctor's shift changed for morning, the doctors called me in first thing. He apologised. He couldn't believe that I sat that long with a suspected clot. Done everything right away in the corridor, though, on a bed for myself. That evening, then at 8 o'clock, I then got a military award. And it wasn't a ward, it was a makeshift bed.
Oh, Niamh. How long were you in? How long were you in, Niamh?
I was in for 3 days.
And how are you doing now?
Oh, I'm great, I'm out. But I want to say the nurses in the Royal, in the ward, were absolutely amazing. And they can't apologise enough in any other, but it's just crazy.
So overflowing toilets, people misbehaving, things kind of out of control because they're overrun.
It was just ordering KFC, just to eat to the reception. Like, if you're that sick, really, do you need to be ordering food? You know, and our elderly just lying there. And I worked in elderly care, as I said, for 10 years. And it just broke my heart. I was like, I fought cancer. And you're just sitting in a chair for 24 hours to be seen for a suspected blood clot. But it's not the doctor's fault or the nurse's.
You sound a lot stronger now, and thank you for phoning in. Thanks to everyone who's phoning in, including Anne. Anne, good morning to you.
Good morning, Mark.
What do you want to talk about?
Mark, why are we not speaking about infection control here? I'm 70 years old, breast cancer survivor. I would be considered vulnerable. I am really staying at home, and the only time I do go out is for medical appointments. Now, I attend a cancer clinic. Nobody is masking up in there.
Mm.
If I attend my GP, patients are sitting coughing in the waiting room. And because I'm so vulnerable, I really don't want to be around anyone coughing. But you speak about care workers going around the community.
Yes.
They're visiting very ill people. Surely it's possible that they can carry the flu from one person to the next. And I would like to know who made the decision to stop the mask wearing and what evidence did they use? the mask wearing wasn't needed.
I think, Anne, it's voluntary. You maybe heard Chris Suter make the point that maybe some of us just got a bit fed up with wearing a mask, and that's part of the problem post the pandemic.
That's not what I'm talking about, Mark. I'm talking about medical staff. You know, I attend a cancer unit on a regular basis, and I mask up, and as soon as I go into the room, I ask for the window to be opened. I have asked several times, why are you not wearing a mask? And the answer I was given was, we don't have to.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we're talking about young, very dedicated nurses, but they've got children at school,
yes, okay,
elderly parents, and I just don't understand why there is not a conversation going about infection control.
Yeah, well, that's why we have the Nolan Show. We're having that conversation. And thank you very much indeed. Let's go to Mark. What a lovely name you have. Hi, Mark.
Thank you, Mark. Good morning.
What's your point?
Well, I'd like to say it's a pretty horrific picture that we have of our health service in Northern Ireland. And I can only agree with the people that have spoken. But Professor Deirdre Heenan hit the nail on the head. Nobody appears to be able to make the appropriate decision to the solution. The solution to the problem of 500 people in beds medically fit to be discharged is not a difficult one to resolve. And I know the people, and I have been lucky enough to be in business long enough to have that solution. We tried to introduce it to the health service here 2 or 3 years ago. The problem was it was disseminated down to each of the trusts.
Hmm.
The people at the trusts were incredibly interested.
So what is the solution, Mark?
It's step-down beds.
Okay.
It's step-down beds, and they can be delivered very, very quickly with the staff.
Where are you getting the staff? Where are you getting the money?
The money is the problem. The money is the problem. But if this is a crisis, and if it's a crisis that is causing people to lose their lives, then the money should, and I'm going to say could, be found. And it's going to be Mike Nesbitt in his position, or the Department of Health. They need to make the money available on a Northern Irish level. When it goes to the trust, it becomes too complicated. The contracts for procurement of services are too complicated, and the people can't get it done. It's easy to do.
We've only got 30 seconds left. In a sentence, Mark, should more people be wearing masks?
Oh, I agree. Absolutely.
You agree?
Yes, absolutely.
Chris Suter, final thought to you. Would you think of setting an example and donning your mask for the rest of the week?
Well, do you know what, Mark? I have beautiful kind of Suter Brothers masks made from previous COVID. So it would actually be, it'd be a fashion accessory for me, Mark. But, you know, on a more serious note, look, see, if push came to shove and that infection control thing was very much at the point of our minds again, I would have no problem wearing masks. Absolutely. No problem.
Chris Suter, thank you very much indeed. We're talking about COVID, we're talking about masks again, we're talking about whether we should socialise or not. We're talking about another old issue after the 10 o'clock news. We're going to talk about flags. Vinnie Hearle, I remember him. I remember him. He used to work on this show, and he's now a star of Radio Ulster and, of course, BBC Sounds. Do download that podcast if you can. We're now going to talk about flags. Do we need a new commission to decide where flags should and shouldn't be flown? You know, a wee bit like the Parades Commission. Something, someone, somebody to regulate flags so they don't end up where they're not wanted. And also, on the other side of the coin, that they can be put up where they are wanted. Now, the Alliance Party is trying to get through new legislation at Stormont. But first, before it actually puts all the detail into this private member's bill, it has launched a consultation. Apparently hundreds of people have already taken part. Let's talk to the Alliance MLA, Paula Bradshaw, who's behind this. Good morning, Paula.
Good morning, Mark.
Summarise it for us as quickly as you can, what exactly you have in mind.
Okay, well, the proposals are to bring forward legislation for a new framework through which there will be the lawful erection of flags, emblems, bunting, posters, etc. on street furniture. And what I'm talking about there is lighting columns and telegraph poles, for example. So what that would do would allow organisations to state where they're going to put the flags, when they're going up, when they're coming down, what's the purpose, and the actual flag itself or the emblem. And what that will do is give transparency to this process. I, as a South Belfast MLA, have been contacted hundreds of times over the years from people who are frustrated. Sometimes they see flags that have been put up, and when I speak to them, they say, look, if I only knew who put them up and when they're coming down, I could live with this. So basically what we're doing is it's a positive piece of legislation so that there is a framework through which people from different cultural backgrounds can celebrate, commemorate, but what we would be hoping to do through this legislation is to eradicate territory marking. And we see that frequently on new housing developments, for example.
Okay, so let's talk through the practicalities of this. If somebody wanted to put up a flag, say, on the Orma Road in South Belfast, under your proposal, what would have to happen next?
Well, first of all, the consultation only opened yesterday, and I am wanting people to...
I get that.
Okay.
But what's your dream for this?
So an organisation would say, for example, I'm based on Orma Road, a local community group, would say, look, we're doing a celebration for a royal wedding, for example. We're going to do it for a week. We're going to put these flags here, this bunting here, and we will take them down on this date. Perfect. That's about shared space. That's about inclusion. And that's about allowing people to celebrate. So there would be a body, whether it's the Department for Infrastructure, the local councils, or a new body set up, who would actually work through those. And it would only be, as with the Praise Commission, a very, very small minority that there wouldn't be permission to proceed. And that would be, for example, where there are flags outside a place of worship, for example. And again, I'm consulting on that. There's a question that my consultation, or it's an interface where there's been known to be trouble in the past. So it's really about just putting the parameters in place, cleaning up the law. We know that there's this thing going between the Department of Infrastructure and PSNI all the time about whose responsibility it is to take down, and it's about cleaning it up.
Dare I say it, royal weddings don't happen very often, but the 12th of July happens every year.
Somebody
wants to put a union flag on part of the Orma Road, say near the Orange Hall there, on a lamppost. What do they do next?
Well, obviously that is a celebration of culture and the tradition of the Orange Order and many within the Unionist community. So they would put a notification in that they were going to do this, and if they wanted to have them up for 3 months or they wanted them up for 3 weeks or 2 weeks, whatever, then they would include that in the notification. So there's a bit of concern that I'm trying to limit the time. I'm certainly not, but what I'm trying to do is garner opinions in terms of what people feel are acceptable periods of time that flags can go up in busy thoroughfares like the Orma Road, for example.
And rightly or wrongly, some unionists will say, are you really going to involve the Department for Infrastructure, which currently has a Sinn Féin minister at the head?
Well, it is a collective executive in the Assembly. We have been set up as a legislature to bring together different opinions, political opinions, going forward. It will be the Infrastructure Committee themselves, which is made up of a broad range of political parties, who will do the scrutiny work on this piece of legislation. It will be debated in the Chamber. The committee themselves actually will have their own consultation process. So this will not come down to one minister. This will be the Assembly passing it, and it will be on the Sinn Féin minister to deliver on the law that comes out of that process.
And you make a good point that, you know, you haven't totally made your mind up. You're having a consultation, and that's online, and people, no matter whether they support the Alliance Party or not, can contribute to that consultation.
Absolutely.
And one of your ideas might be a kind of arm's length body, a quango, and I don't mean that in a negative way, which is independent, with a head or a board. Have you anyone in mind that might be the best person to lead that?
You're running way ahead of yourself here, Honestly, we just want to see what the... want as many people as possible. Yeah. We've had 950 responses already within the first 24 hours. People care about this issue, and I want to hear from as many people as possible.
I asked that question, Paula Bradshaw, because I have an idea. Professor Dominic Bryan was co-chair of the Stormont body set up to examine flags and identity almost 10 years ago. And surprise, surprise, he's on the line. Good morning, Professor.
I could see where you were going with that, Mark.
Would you fancy it, Dominic?
No, I think my own feeling is that that's a too complex way of dealing with this. I don't think that, Paul is right, we've got to think in detail about how this gets done, but I don't think setting up a commission is really the way to go forward. I think it's, in some ways, it's a simpler, more basic system that is required of some sort of a notification if we're going to go down that route. The real issue, it becomes, how do you police that? There is, at the moment, it's interesting, because at the moment, there is a piece of legislation. You talked about a Sinn Féin or an SDLP minister being the head of Department of Infrastructure. There is a piece of legislation right at the moment which makes it technically illegal to fly a flag on a lamppost. Section 87 of the 1993 Roads Order makes it illegal. So even though we've had Sinn Féin and SDLP ministers and Department of Infrastructure, they've never done anything about it, even though there is a piece of legislation which would allow them to do so.
So what do you think of Paula's idea?
Well, I think this is a problem that needs dealing with. I think we've got to balance freedom of expression, people's right to celebrate and commemorate, which people do all over the world using flags. So it's quite reasonable to do that, against the fact that they are used as territory markers, they are used to mark paramilitary space, it impacts on people's lives, it impacts on housing issues quite substantially, and a lot of people see the way flags are left up as disrespectful. This is not as important as the other stuff you've been talking about, like sorting out our health system, but it does impact people's everyday lives. So I do think Paula's right that we need to try and do something that is different. We've just got to try and come up with a system which keeps things in perspective. We don't need to spend loads of money on this. We just need to subtly adjust the sort of behaviours that go on around this.
The consultation is underway. TUV Councillor Ron McDowell is on the line. Are you going to contribute to this online consultation, Ron?
Yes, I've already done so. I had a look at it this morning and I filled in my response as an individual. And one of the things I would say from the start of this, if there is going to be an honest broker to try and look at this fairly and openly, it's not going to be Paula and it's not going to be the Alliance Party. The Alliance Party have an agenda in all of this. They have a long-established agenda.
Let's deal with the issue, Ron.
Removing flags. And that's what the issue is. The issue is about removing flags. That's what this is about. The Alliance Party, Belfast City Hall, supported the removal of the flag over the official government building. They supported the removal of the flag on Stormont. They support now policing flags and maybe even suggestions in their questions about making them time sensitive, about prosecutions. And it's really just another cheap shot from the Alliance Party aimed at the unionist community.
Paula Bradshaw?
Well, that's very disrespectful that he's personalising this. The Fifth Commission that was co-chaired by Dominic Bryan, they spent £800,000. It's very clear that this is an issue that needs to be dealt with by society. I got fed up as an elected representative for too many people shunning this. We've had successive infrastructure ministers who should have dealt with this. And I have just said, I have had enough of this. So many people in South Belfast want and beyond want this issue addressed. It's very clear from the number of responses that have come through in the last 24 hours that people really care about this issue, and I just got fed up waiting on ministers doing it, and I thought I would take it forward as a private member's bill to suggest that the Alliance Party are trying to eradicate anybody's flag or identity is a complete nonsense. What I'm doing is trying to protect cultural expression through this piece of legislation, which will stop the endless niggling every single year about where flags go up, if there's transparency around it, and if people will buy into the code of practice, then I think we will have a far more harmonious and inclusive society. And that's what we all signed up to in the Good Friday Agreement.
Ron McDowell, Paula Bradshaw makes the point, it's not just union flags. It could be Irish flags, it could be Palestinian flags that some members of your party have objected to in recent days.
Of course it could, and that's where the conversation should start. But it's all sleight of hand, because the conversation from the start has been about royal commemorations.
Oh, Ron, that's not a good line. We're trying to improve that line.
But only now, sorry?
It wasn't only a good line. I will let you go. Keep going.
Okay, so only when there's kickback from unionism do we say, oh, it's not just about attacking unionism, this is about all sources of culture and heritage, and there is kickback. There is legislation already in place that deals with these issues. You can have Article 9, freedom of thought, your freedom of conscience, your freedom of religion, freedom of expression and assembly.
Oh, Ron, it's not a great line. We'll try and improve that line. Dominic Brown, were you encouraged, like me, to hear Ron McDowell say that even though he objected to what Paula Bradshaw is trying to do, he took part in the consultation, he had a say?
Yeah, and when we ran the commission, we didn't get agreement on everything, I have to say that, but we had broad agreement that something needed to be done. I mean, it's always odd when you have a piece of legislation which a department completely ignores because it's inconvenient. There needs to be change in this area so that we can create an environment where people can celebrate their identity, commemorate their identity, and express their politics, which is a quite reasonable part being in a democracy. To being British and being Irish is something that people should be able to do. But the reality is that flags are used to intimidate, to control areas. They're left up a long time in ways that are often disrespectful. And that's true not only of unionist areas, but nationalist areas. And we just need to find the right way to gauge this in a way that can create a better space for people to have those celebrations and commemorations.
Because, and I know you've talked to me about this privately, I mean, I'm not sure you've got a flag fetish. You're a flag fanatic. They are important.
They are important, yeah. We're vexillologists is the word for people. They're important because they express people's sense of identity. They are part of people's lives. People, you know, when they have sporting events, when they have social events, you know, they are part of people's history. So they play a real part in people's emotional identity. And because of that, we need to take them seriously. We've got to be very careful about how we use them. So you can't just dismiss this as something which is not important. Because if you look at any country in the world, if you look at any place in the world, these symbols are important to people's personal identities.
Including yours, Ron McDowell. I hear you're back. Is it at least worth having this conversation? What do you think?
The conversation around flags has to be taken. But where my concern is that the Alliance Party aren't the honest brokers to have the conversation. We know they have an agenda, and that's brought out in a track record of an attack on the unionist people. Now, recently, they refused to give a £500 increase to a VE Day grant in Ards. They also talked about commemorating be allowed to commemorate.
Ron, there's a lot of whataboutery here that I don't know too much about.
Can I finish
that point.
I'll finish the point. They also talk about commemoration. There was commemoration on Ards Borough Council, on the war memorials on Ards Borough Council. The Alliance Party used a call-in against 85% support for the Union flag to be flown over the war memorials, and the Alliance Party saw fit to bring it down. Now, the Union flag may be sufficient for people to die under, but it's not sufficient for it to be flown over the war memorials. Okay. The Alliance Party aren't worthy to be involved in this conversation. They've lost the support and the confidence of the Unionist people, and they can't broker agreement on this issue.
Paula.
Well, I submitted my proposal to the Speaker of this Assembly in July. I have followed the guidance from the Speaker's office and the Bill's office in terms of the consultation process. I want people to feed into this, and then I will hand over the results to the Infrastructure Committee, as I said earlier. They will be the ones that will do the full scrutiny on this piece of legislation. So I think that it is disingenuous for him to say that we're not the honest brokers. We're not trying to be, but what we're trying to do is demonstrate the strength of feeling across all of society about the need to address this issue once and for all.
Stay with us. Teresa's on the line from Ballanderry. Morning, Teresa.
Good morning, Mark. How are you?
Good.
Mark, this issue about flags. If there's a celebration on, put your flag up and take them down again. I'd like to ask Ron McDowell, why did they feel the need to put paramilitary flags outside a chapel and leave them there? At the moment, I can look at one flying outside my local chapel, and that's from last year. Why did they feel the need to do that? And he talked about putting the flag above the war memorials. It wasn't all British or Unionists that died in those wars. It was all sorts of people.
Thanks, Teresa. We'll let Ron come back there.
Just the issue on paramilitary flags. Paramilitary flags glorify heinous acts carried out by terrorists. And the police have laws that they can enable to bring those flags down. They have the Terrorism Act, the Common Law, the Public Order legislation, and offences under the Roads Act and things like that that the police can use. So the legislation already exists to bring down paramilitary flags that would glorify acts of terrorism. But when you talk about a British Army War Memorial, then everybody who died under that is a British soldier. So they are all British on a British War Memorial.
Let's go back to the lines. Alan is in South Belfast. What's your point, Alan?
Oh, hello, Mark. You're talking about healthcare and waiting lists and all that sort of stuff. I had a lot of experience looking after my wife who had Parkinson's and passed away about 2 years ago. One of the things I found was that when we were looking at discharges from hospital, some of the discharges were almost unrealistic. People like OTs were specifying four visits a day, half an hour a day, and nursing in bed. Whereas when you're ill, you go into hospital to be cured, you come back out and try to reable yourself as fast as possible.
Okay.
My point is that sometimes part of the risk management around discharges is just over the top and absorbs scarce social care resources, which are simply not there. I mean, you spend... give me sort of 2 hours support a day. I'm here on my own for the other 22 hours. Whatever we do, I need to be able to cope with. So there's no point overspecking a care package, which just has no reality.
Alan, thank you. I think you've actually put this all into a bit of context, talking about the health pressure, losing your wife and all of that. Paula Bradshaw, listening to Alan there, should you not be doing something else with your private member's bill at Stormont?
Well, I think that's not really fair. My colleague Danny Donnelly was on your show earlier, talking about what he and Ilan McAllister, our two health leads, are doing, and they'll be attending the emergency meeting this afternoon. We as a party have worked very hard. I'm no longer the health spokesperson for my party, but people will know how hard I work to try and push forward the transformation agenda.
Let me phrase it a bit better. You're right, that was a bit clumsy. But just generally, is this the best use of your time? Why is it so important?
Well, it's an issue that's really important to people in South Belfast, where I was elected, and across the board. We want to build, that's our USP in the Alliance Party, we want to develop a shared and inclusive society. And we feel that a regulated framework where there can be the lawful flying of flags that celebrate and commemorate should be put in place.
Okay.
It's for everyone's benefit.
Okay. I want to ask you about the timescale for your private member's bill before the end of the show. We've only got a couple of minutes left. We've got one more caller. Albert. Okay. Albert in Belfast. What's your point?
Good morning, Mark. I have a couple of questions.
Just one, Albert. We've only time for one.
First of all, who is going to make the decision? You're still going to be able to put a flag on a lamppost?
Yep. Somebody's going to have to make that decision.
Who's going to make the decision? Are we going to end up with a praise commission again? And the thing is, who's going to make the decision how long you can leave them up? And what areas you're going to be able to do it? Is that all going to be in the legislation? Come on. The Alliance Party took the flag down on the City Hall. They helped to take it down on Stormont. The Republic fly the flag all year round. Why can't we fly our flag on Stormont and the City Hall?
Paula Bradshaw, Albert does make a point.
What is the problem with that, Mark?
Well, I don't want to revisit that whole issue of the City Hall. Bear with me, Albert. Bear with me. I want to put your question to Paula. Ultimately, somebody is going to have to make the decision. You can't deny that.
There are questions in the consultation that cover that, and I would encourage your caller and everyone else listening to respond to it, because we want as many voices, as many opinions to feed in to help shape this going forward. In terms of City Hall, that is
We went with the designated days.
Don't worry about that. Process. Don't worry about that.
Okay. Okay.
But that, ultimately, you know how this place works.
Yes, I know.
That whoever it is will all be looking into their background. Whoever it is, it's going to be the minister or the chair of a commission. We're going to be looking into their background and going, right. And they said this and they said that. But that's reality, isn't it?
Well, that is, and we're just trying to move it forward. And this conversation's been going on for decades now, and we would really like a workable solution that meets the needs of everyone in society. But just to come to your point around the timescale, so
yes,
the consultation runs until the end of March. I will then obviously analyse and work with the Bills Office. We will then start getting it drafted, and then first reading, I don't know, maybe in the autumn of this year, and then obviously it will take, you know, go to second reading, and then it will go to the committee, who will probably take three to 4 months to do their scrutiny work. So this is not a short-term process, and there will be opportunities way beyond my own consultation for people from the public and organisations to feed in.
And let's play fantasy politics just finally, Dominic Bryan. Say this actually happens, and they are looking for someone. I joked at the start, but your CV would be hard to beat.
Well, do you know what? People do need to sometimes make some difficult decisions on these things. People who've worked on the Parades Commission over a year, I know it's not loved by some people, but they have done a difficult job in making some difficult decisions. And every so often we need people in our society to stand up and make some tricky decisions which need a level of balance and thought going into them.
You haven't answered my question, Professor.
I don't know. I'd like. Do you know what? You'd need to have a system which didn't really involve one decision maker and one commission. It needs to have a code of conduct where there's a great deal of clarity, and those more marginal decisions might even involve just councils going round or the Department of Infrastructure going round and taking the flags down themselves after a particular time. I don't think we want to get into very contested territory when it comes to those sort of things.
I take it you looked at this idea when you had your committee.
Yeah, we did. We did look at it. And our general feeling was that having a new commission to do something probably was not the best idea. I mean, as Paula says, people have got to put their ideas in. I'm not wedded to not having one, but I think it would be much better if it was a very simple functional system. You put in the time you were going to put your flags up for. If they didn't weren't taken down, then there would have to be something enacted by the Department of Infrastructure to do that job.
And a dangerous last question for you, Professor Dominic Bryan, as somebody who is a self-confessed flag fanatic, have you a favourite flag?
Have I a favourite flag? Mark, my favourite flag flies at Tottenham Hotspur Football Club, I have to say. And that's the one.
Yeah.
Difficulty is to show loyalty sometimes.
Yeah.
That's the one that's my favourite flag.
Yeah, and they have to fly it at half-mast, given the current form of the team. Most of the time. Thanks to Dominic Bryan, thanks to Ron McDowell, and thanks to Paula Bradshaw. Thanks for your company today. We're here all week. Keep your calls coming. We're going to talk a bit about Blair Meehan tomorrow. In the meantime, another legend, Connor Phillips.
The biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet at Stephen Nolan.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this, the secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.